I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Boris Karloff. Anybody remember that name? Karloff is the fellow who introduced me to Hans Christian Andersen's stories. I listened to those recordings over and over again when I was young. The Ugly Duckling, the Princess and the Pea. This was all on LPs, vinyl. And these fairy tales on the vinyl, they were scratchy because of the way we treated those LPs as kids. But amid all the crackling and the sputtering of those records, we heard the stories, we heard the tales. And maybe you, too, grew up with some classics from Hans Christian Andersen, from The Emperor's New Clothes to The Little Mermaid and others. What escapes the eyes and ears of many people today, though, even people who grew up with Hans Christian Andersen's stories, is the sheer volume of tales he told, well over 150 original tellings. And in that mix are some gems worth hearing that have not been relegated to the ash heap, but are without a doubt unjustly neglected. We're going to try to remedy that a little bit here today on the show. And we'll do that by exploring a few of these lesser-known tales. I'm going to do it with Julie Allen, a professor of comparative literature and Scandinavian studies at the Brigham Young University Department of Comparative Arts and Letters. She's in the studio with us. Professor Allen, thank you for coming.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks.
Do you remember any – is this a fair question? Your first Hans Christian Andersen story – when you were a kid?
It's hard to know exactly. I grew up with these big books of fairy tales, and they lumped all kinds of tales together. So it was kind of the Andrew Lang fairy tale book, where you had some Grimm's, you had some Oscar Wilde, you had some Hans Christian Andersen. And so I don't know when I first knew that I had encountered Hans Christian Andersen's story, but I think maybe The Little Match Girl was the one that first really struck me, and that struck me as something somebody told on purpose.
That's a very interesting point you make, because some stories just seem that they're surely for entertainment value. Hans Christian Andersen, maybe a little less so.
Well, I mean, it's also the fact that some stories just kind of are organic. They just pop up everywhere and you hear 100 different versions. And some stories are so particular, you feel like they have to have an author behind them.
So that Match Girl story, I know I'm asking you an impossible question, but can you kind of put us where you – 8 years old, 10, 12, 16, when you encountered that? Because to think in that kind of interpretive way, that this story has a purpose, that's kind of sophisticated.
I must have been about 10 or 12. I was, you know, an avid reader. But I remember feeling like The Little Match Girl and really identifying with what would it be like if your parents didn't want you, if your parents sent you out to sell matches in the snow. And I was in Hawaii, so I didn't really have any conception of snow. But I could see how miserable she was and feeling her longing for family, for food, for shelter. I think that's what made me think, why would anyone tell a story like this? What's the point?
You know, to feel the suffering of others, that just seems to be – that's kind of bedrock, it seems, for Hans Christian Andersen. I'm thinking of Ugly Duckling. For now, when I was a kid, it wasn't the Match Girl. It was that Ugly Duckling, and I just felt – personally assaulted by the idea that somebody would tell a story of an ugly duckling that had to make good in life somehow.
Right, whose friends were mean to him. I mean, we've all, I think, experienced that. But to be able to take ourselves outside of our own experience and recognize that this is something that a lot of people experience, that there's often unjust, I think that's exactly what Andersen wanted people to do with his stories, was to feel more acutely the things that they hadn't experienced themselves and to understand better the things that they had.
Well, let's get into some of the lesser-known tales here, and we're going to talk a little bit about the man, too, and why he might have been writing these stories in the first place. But of the little handful that you've been talking up lately, one of them has to do with a mother and quite a tragic situation.
It's really one of his most – it's one of his earliest – well, not earliest. It's one of his fairly early stories from the 1840s, and it follows a really classic – fairy tale structure that, as we know, sort of a initial harmony of a mother at home with her child. But then in true fairy tale fashion, something happens to create a lack. And in some stories, you know, it's a parent dying or a contest being called out. But in this case, it's a knock at the door. And she's at home with her child. The child is ill. She's been tending him. She opens the door and it's an old man asking for shelter by her fireside. And she lets him in and tells him how afraid she is for her child, how much she has wept over him and wanted him to get well, and how tired she is from watching by his bedside. And she asks him to just keep an eye on the baby for a minute while she closes her eyes. And when she opens her eyes, the child is gone and the man is gone. And she rushes out into the night, crying for her child. And Night comes to her and says, oh, that was death that took your child. And so that, I think, is every parent's nightmare, right? That your child somehow is lost. And so she, like any mother, decides to go find her child, to go on a quest, if you will. And so she quests through the night and encounters a rose bush that trades her heart's blood for information on which way death went, a river that lets her trade her eyes. She cries her eyes out and gives her eyes to the river for a passage over to death's greenhouse, an old woman who is willing to tell her which way to find her own child by trading her white hair for the mother's long dark hair. And so when she arrives at the greenhouse of death, now aged and wept, you know, eyes having wept out, she sees all these plants and has to decide which one is her child. And when death comes, he says, how did you get here before me? And she says, I'm a mother. And you see how what lengths a mother will go to, and she's passed all of these tests to get there and redeem her child. But death says, I'm just doing a job. I'm God's gardener. I just transplant these plants from here into his garden on the other side. What would you have me do? And she grabs two plants and says, I'll tear these plants up if you don't give me back my child. And he says, make some other mother just as unhappy as you are. And she sighs and says, no, I don't want that. I just want my child. And he says, well, let me show you something. And he shows her in a glass. One of those plants will grow up to be a person who does so much good in the world and brings happiness and joy and makes the world a better place. And one will be a terrible person who suffers and causes suffering. He says, one of those is your child's fate. Now you choose from those two plants in your hands. And she can't. She realizes this is the test she can't pass. She doesn't know which child, and would she wish that fate of suffering on her own child. And so she says, God's will be done. Forgive me when I ask things that are against your will, Lord, because I don't know best. And so she sits and lets death take her child into the unknown land, which is her reward. Normally in a fairy tale, the reward is you get half the kingdom, you get the princess, you get everything you want. But in this case, she gets hope only that she has chosen right, that her child will be happier and that she'll be reunited with him someday. It's really kind of a heartbreaking tale, but I think it's meant to give us hope.
You know, this isn't Disney stuff.
Well, Disney has done a lot of Andersen stories, but they tend to take out the hard parts and make them shinier.
And before I even just spend too much time bashing Disney on this account, this hardly seems like a child's tale.
Well, a child's tale for a time when kids lost siblings, when the mortality rate was really high, to understand, what if I die? What will my mother do for me? What choices does she have? I mean, I think there's a way you can read it as a child's tale, but certainly in our century, it doesn't seem like the kind of thing people want to tell their children. They want their children to be protected from the knowledge of sorrow and loss.
Was he writing these stories expressly for children to read?
Well, he was. He tried a lot of other kinds of genres, and he continued to write plays and novels and travelogues and all kinds of short stories. But in 1835, he wrote his very first collection of tales told for children. And that was a new thing. Nobody was writing for children. People only wrote didactic stories for children, like the Stuvelpeter, the German story about a child who wouldn't eat his dinner and he blew away like a tumbleweed. I mean, terrifying stories. And Andersen does something else, right? He writes these stories that are entertaining and beautiful and compelling, but they still have a depth that suggests he was also writing for adults.
There's a lot of death going on in his tales. And I guess I'm a very modern daddy because I think in terms of sparing my children unnecessary pain, unnecessary suffering. And so I think we really do have to go back to what you were just talking about in the world in which he lived. People of all classes, all ages, in Scandinavia where he was living, throughout Europe, death was a frequent visitor. And there was no getting around that, I guess.
Right. And I think that we can't get around it either, but we think we can. And so we're caught off guard when there's a natural disaster or a pandemic or something where people are dying because we don't really know what to do with it. And it's a little bit like what Atul Gawande says in Being Mortal, that it's the familiarity with death that helps us come to terms with it more easily. And so reading Andersen is a way sort of to get that vicariously.
So you don't think he was an anomaly in his day, focusing on morose themes, whereas other people around him were skirting those issues? Was he just like one of many authors who would talk about death and dying?
Oh, sure. Have you read Dickens?
I mean, well, there you go. There's one example.
They were actually friends for a while, and Anderson visited Dickens in England. And so I think they definitely had a shared perspective on the world that suggested that a realistic view will equip you better than purely fantastical. But Anderson had a lot more fantasy than Dickens, too.
And it wasn't just about mortality either. That's just one type of suffering that happens to people. But the idea that we live in a world that has all sorts of problems, from disease to poverty, hunger, the dire straits that people find themselves in, he kind of ran the gamut of that thematically.
He certainly did. But he didn't do it just to make people feel bad. I think he always depicted those kinds of problems in a way that suggested that faith and hope and hard work and luck and imagination were ways either to get out of those situations or to deal with them. Even The Little Match Girl, I think, is a story of emancipation and empowerment.
Well, let's talk about his own life story, his biography, his thematic choices and the tales he tells. Do they in ways emanate from his own biography where you can kind of connect the dots?
To a certain extent, sure. I mean, Denmark gets a lot of press nowadays as sort of a democratic socialist paradise, and it does have a really good welfare state and a lot of benefits for citizens and a safety net that makes a lot of these bumps softer. But in Anderson's day, that was still a pipe dream. He lived in a time when you really did fail, and if you didn't have the money or the background, you had nothing. And his father was a war veteran suffering from PTSD, a cobbler who made shoes in the family home. His mother was a washerwoman who often couldn't afford food and sometimes would drink instead because it was like liquid bread. It was cheaper and kept you warm. And so he lived in this little tiny one-room house where he slept on a bench, and his parents lived and worked in the same room. And the only thing he had to make his life brighter was stories. And so I think for him, stories are a way out, but they make it more believable when they're grounded in that reality of a time when most people suffered all the time, or most of the time at least.
So you're already putting into the foreground an idea that our suffering in life can be somehow either mitigated or somehow softened, I guess, by something as simple as a story. I mean, this brings up the whole issue of the role of the arts in our lives.
Absolutely. And for Anderson, the arts were a way out of poverty. They're also his way to climb the social ladder. He goes to Copenhagen when he's 14 years old, all by himself, knocking on doors and tap dancing for strangers, trying to make a career. And it's hard, and nobody believes in him. And he works and works and works. And I wouldn't say that he had a smooth sailing even after he was famous. He still had, you know, relationship problems and never owned his own home and traveled from house to house. But he saw how much those stories meant not only to himself but to people around him. And so I think he knew from his own life how much that matters to have that outlet.
All of this is leading up to another story that involves a goblin and poetry, and we're going to talk about that fascinating tale after a short break here on our show. We're visiting with Julie Allen. She's a professor of comparative literature and Scandinavian studies at Brigham Young University, talking about a few of the tales that Hans Christian Andersen gave to the world that are off the beaten path, some lesser-known tales. Stay tuned to more Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. It's a pleasure to be with you, and thanks for joining with me and today with Julie Allen. We're talking up Hans Christian Andersen's tales, and not necessarily the classic tales that everybody, or most everybody, grows up with or that Disney has provided for us in some version or another, maybe not true to the originals. We're talking about some of the lesser-known tales, the forgotten tales of Hans Christian Andersen. And Julie, I should mention, Julie Allen, a professor of comparative literature and Scandinavian studies at BYU. Julie, we were just talking about he had a great concern for the idea that things that go wrong in life, things that are painful, things that bring suffering, hunger, disease, death, all of the misfortune, financial woes, all of these things can somehow be made more bearable or maybe even more understandable with some access to poetry or stories or the arts. I don't know if he was into music or not or painting or what have you, but very much stories and the written word. You know, I think that's kind of a hard sell for a lot of moderns.
I think you're right. I think we've kind of become so accustomed to having easy access to art and literature that we don't really appreciate how much it meant to people who couldn't have it. And for Anderson, who had to fight for every scrap of education he got, for every visit to the theater as a child or a young man, I think he really appreciated how much it mattered. And he was an artist. He made amazing paper cuttings, really elaborate ones, and he wanted to be a singer. He auditioned for the Royal Opera until his voice broke. He even tried to be a dancer, but he wasn't very good. So the arts sort of in general were a big part of his life.
So there's a tale, and I want to get to this goblin and poetry, and the title, I'll let you give it to us. But this brings up the idea that there's a contest, maybe a trade-off between will you eat food or will you be sustained by ideas?
I think it's a struggle that we all have, and every student I teach is juggling those same needs to earn a living and provide for their family, but also do things that they love and that they find emotionally satisfying. So the story you mentioned is called The Goblin and the Grocer. And the goblin isn't kind of a goblin like in the Tolkien Lord of the Rings sense. It's more of a little elf. And again, a little elf. The Danes have a concept of the elf called the Nisse that is sort of a house elf, more like Dobby from Harry Potter. And that's the kind of goblin he's talking about. And this goblin lives in a grocer's shop. And he lives there because the grocer gives him porridge. And in Denmark, you always give the elf porridge at Christmas to make sure that he stays your friend and keeps things running around your house or your farm. And so this goblin is loyal to the grocer because of the porridge. But a student lives upstairs in the attic of the grocer's house, and he comes down one day to buy his dinner, some bread and a hunk of cheese, and as the grocer begins to pack in the cheese, he uses a piece of paper torn from a book. And the student stops him and says, wait, what book is that from? And the man says, I don't know, some old lady traded it for some coffee beans. And the student says, you can keep the cheese. I can live on bread alone. I'll take the book instead. And so he trades his dinner for this book. And the goblin thinks, what kind of maniac would rather have a book than cheese? And so he follows the student up to his garret. And he peeks through the keyhole as the student opens the book. And he watches in wonder as this tree of knowledge emerges from the book. Shining leaves and beautiful faces and lights and music, and it just fills the room, and the goblin is astounded. And so he goes back down to all the other implements and artifacts in the grocery store that night, and he asks them all what they know of poetry. And they say, oh, poetry is just something printed on the back page of the newspaper, and they need to fill space. And he thinks, okay, well, I don't need poetry in my life. But he always wonders about it, and he sneaks up at night to watch the student reading, and he's mystified and fascinated by what he sees. And then one night there's a fire in the grocer's house. Well, he thinks it's in the grocer's house, and people are shouting fire, and everyone's running around grabbing what they can. And so the goblin runs upstairs to the student's garret. The student's not there, and he grabs the book, and he climbs out on the roof, and he sees now that the fire is on the opposite side of the street, so his book isn't in danger, but he also realizes that in the moment of crisis, what he really, really wanted to save was the book, was the knowledge, was the stories. And so he sits there on the roof for a while and wonders what he should do, trying to serve these two masters. And he realizes that he can't choose, that he needs both of them. And then Anderson's narrator tells us at the end that all of us need our porridge too. And so he understands that we don't just need art. We can't just live from stories, but we can't really live without them either.
So you're saying that Hans Christian Andersen, in this concession that people need food to sustain themselves, he's not going to be some overly romanticized idealist about just living off of the beauty of the word. He's just not going to do that?
No, I think he's a different generation than that. He experienced poverty enough to know that there's nothing romantic about starving. But he also knew that being starved of art and beauty would be fatal in other ways.
Now, you've mentioned university students and you work with them. And is this kind of a case that you have tried to make to young freshmen, sophomores coming into college?
I have. I mean, as a literature professor, it is kind of an uphill battle to convince people that they need these stories in their lives. But I have seen so many students who are majoring in everything from business to kinesiology read stories and recognize the power of them in their lives to help them understand the challenges they face, to help them relate to other people better, to just see the world more brightly. And so I see it again and again every semester.
And is it possible to describe the world of Hans Christian Andersen sufficiently that the people, your students, who might bump into these kinds of stories can kind of transport themselves back to that time and place and understand the exigencies of life that he was up against?
To some extent, I think they can. I mean, I think we talk about the nature of a society that was pre-democratic, that where there were people that were bound to the land, that they weren't allowed to leave, that they had so few choices. And to see the agency and the courage required for Andersen to strike out and try to change his own world. But I think that they don't necessarily need to understand the context so completely, as long as they understand the themes. They understand this idea of wanting more, of wanting meaning, and trying to balance that with the pragmatism of making a living.
Let's turn to a story next that was written, I guess, about maybe 4 years or so before The Goblin and the Grocer, and this is titled The Flax. And I think to understand this story, it helps to know what flax is in the first place. And so few people know where stuff comes from. But linen, for example, is a product of flax. We think of – a lot of people will go to their health food store and think about flaxseed oil or something like that. They're looking for their omega-3 fatty acids, right? But flax was so essential to some of these northern European societies.
Sure, for making clothing. And so – everybody in Andersen's day would know, and Denmark is still a very agrarian country, and you can drive, you know, throughout the countryside and see fields and fields of all kinds of useful plants. But flax is only useful when it's harvested. I mean, it's beautiful, has beautiful blue flowers, but if you want to either make flaxseed oil or linen, you have to cut it down first.
So what happens in the story of the flax? The flax is a character, I guess.
The flax is the main character. And he is conscious, and he's conscious of how happy he is being a flower, having these beautiful flowers, having the sun shine on him. And he thinks, this is the top of the world. I'm living my best life. But then, because he's a plant that can be used for useful things, he's chopped down and boiled and beaten to be made into linen. And we, as the reader, are supposed to see ourselves as the flax, right? We may not be literally chopped down and boiled and beaten, but figuratively all the time. And so the flax models a kind of response that I don't think most of us naturally bring to tribulations. When things happen, we usually complain and wonder why me. But the flax recognizes, oh, this is how I become the next thing. And so he says, this really hurts, but just think, I'll be useful. I'm going to be linen. It's so exciting. I can't wait to see what becomes of me. But linen by itself, of course, isn't that useful. So he has to go through another stage of trials where they chop him up and pin him and stitch him to make him into clothing, in this case, underwear. Andersen very discreetly mentions it's one of those articles of clothing that all of us need and no one talks about.
Well, you know, until you got to the underwear part, I was thinking this was almost biblical, you know?
Because, I'm sure they were underwear too.
Well, the reason I say this is because there is a connection with the simplicity of this storyline to, say, Christian parables in the New Testament. Am I making too much of this, the idea that the form of the parable, a story told by Jesus, you know, hundreds of years before Hans Christian Andersen, that vehicle is a serviceable way for teaching something?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Andersen does it again and again. People know the story of the fir tree that, you know, becomes a Christmas tree and his experiences. It's a really common way to get people out of their own heads is to let them see the world through the eyes of something inanimate or something simple.
Yeah, and it takes a little bit of work on the person's part to anthropomorphize a seed of flax or a stalk of flax.
But Andersen makes it easy for us because he lets his inanimate objects are so talkative. He has story after story of talking houses and leather paneling and needles and, you know, anything you can imagine. And so the flax is really voluble and talking about his experiences as he's, you know, goes through the process of becoming fabric, becoming underwear. And then once the underwear has fallen to shreds, thinking, well, what do I do now? I'm kind of useless. You know, I'm just this pile of fabric. And then he's boiled and beaten again and pounded into paper. And you might think, oh, great, you know, what now? But he thinks, oh, what an opportunity. What a great surprise. I might get something written on me that will be wonderful. And so that ability to always see the purpose in the things we experience, it feels a little Pollyanna-ish.
I was going to say, you beat me to it.
But if it's, you know, this character that has actually suffered all these things, written by an author who's also suffered a lot of things, it feels a little more plausible as, well, maybe I could try that sometime, you know, when I face something, to instead of first complaining, maybe first think, well, what good might come from this?
There are a lot of different adjectives that we will sometimes apply to a story or a situation that we feel gets right at the crux of our human existence. Sometimes we'll say it's a spiritual idea. Sometimes we'll say it's an intellectual idea. Or sometimes we'll say that it's existential in its nature. Could the man ever move away from these existential questions?
Well, it was kind of an existential time. One of his contemporaries was the philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, who is known as the father of existentialism. And Kierkegaard had critiqued one of Andersen's novels early on in the 1830s and complained that he wasn't existential enough, that he was too bound to his own life. And so I think Andersen really consciously thought about what greater application can there be than just, you know, a quick story at bedtime.
I want to turn to a story next that has a lot of promise in the title, The Most Incredible Thing. You know, if you sell that, you know, it's like The Greatest Showman. You know, use those superlatives, right? That'll win an audience over because people are wondering what on earth might it be or who might it be. What's the most incredible thing about?
It's, again, set up as a sort of traditional fairy tale with a contest where the winner can get half the kingdom and the princess, but that quickly diverges from that pattern and becomes really more of a commentary on society, that people, when asked to define what the most incredible thing is, do all kinds of things. People do gymnastics and spit on their own backs and, you know, try to hold their breath until they pass out. And so the man who initially wins the contest creates a beautiful work of art, a clock that strikes the hour, and at every hour figures come out, figures that have biblical and Christian significance, Moses carrying the tablets of the law, Adam and Eve, ending with the night watchman who announces the birth of Christ when the clock strikes 12. And everyone is so amazed by this clock that they think this is the most incredible thing and award him the prize. But just before he's able to marry the princess, a bully comes in, a big man who with a bludgeon who smashes the clock to pieces and destroys it in front of the eyes of this audience that has just decided this beautiful thing is the most incredible thing. And no one can believe that he would do it. And so as they're sort of stammering and wondering, they say, well, that's incredible. That's unbelievable. That's the most unbelievable thing. Someone who could take something so beautiful and destroy it. And so it kind of becomes this, again, like in The Goblin and the Grocer, this tussle between sort of ephemeral things of beauty and really down-to-earth, pragmatic, tough-as-nails moments. And this guy who has broken the clock, he seems to have won. And so Andersen says the princess was kind of put out, but she got to wear new clothes either way, so she wasn't protesting too much. And everyone goes along with this wedding, and they go to the church, and they're marching down the aisle, and everyone's sort of a little in awe and a little afraid of this man who's broken the clock. But then the clock comes back. And the editor tells us you can destroy the clock, but you can't destroy the spirit of the work of art. And so the clock comes back and each of the figures steps forward and condemns the man for what he's done. Moses breaks the tablets of the law and says, you have misunderstood the law of God. And Adam and Eve come out and say that they are ashamed of their offspring. And finally, the night watchman, after each of the figures has come and condemned the bully, the night watchman steps out with his nightstick. And he smashes the man in the head and he says that this is, as you have sown, so shall you reap. And so this man is then presumably dead on the ground. And the clock, the spirit of the clock, then flames up like fire in the church. And everyone is amazed at this, filled with light. And they say that was the most incredible thing they'd ever seen, this miracle. But then they still have the problem of who's won the contest. So they go back to the first guy who built the clock and they say, well, I guess it's you. And they bring him back and he gets to marry the princess. And the narrator tells us that everyone was happy for him and no one resented his selection. And that was the most incredible thing.
Do I detect some hint of social commentary going on here? I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of here you have a gullible public that's impressed by the power of malice, of violence, of cruelty.
Absolutely. Andersen was very, very social critical, but always very discreetly socially critical. He was writing, after all, for these upper classes, for people who had the money to buy his books, for the patrons who hosted him in their houses. But he also didn't want to give them a pass to help them realize gently, elusively, through parables, if you will, that maybe they should think things through differently. And so this story, I think, is one of his more outspoken ones, in fact, that really shows that you can't just do whatever you want. Like there will be consequences, if not now, then later.
So if he were alive today, and we have one more story to tell, I'm looking very much forward to hearing about the old oak tree's last dream. But before we get there, if he were alive today and trying to share these stories with people, people would call him preachy. People would say he's moralizing, that he's given too many sermons.
They would. I mean, it was a time when religion was far more integrated into everyday life, especially in Scandinavia. Scandinavians had state religions. I mean, Denmark still does. The church and the state are identical. But people also were more open about their belief. They were more willing to accept that as a source of knowledge. And so Anderson tries to thread the needle, I think, between on the one hand entertaining us so we don't necessarily see it as preachy. And some stories he does get a little more Lutheran, if you will.
And is religiosity a kind of prerequisite to understanding his tales?
I don't think religiosity as such. I mean, there are tales that are very Christian influenced, as the one I just told. But many of them are just, I think, radically inclusive, that they just recognize the value of all people. And for a man like Anderson, whose last name ending in S-E-N was what they call just a sort of mass designation, that wasn't a real name, he really recognized that we don't know the value of other people by their birth or their wealth or their status. And so even in the sort of more secular concept of existentialism as it's become known in the 20th century, I think Anderson still has a lot to teach us.
Yeah. Well, I told you I'm looking forward to the old oak tree's last dream, and I'll tell you why. I'm a man who loves the natural world, and to have figures or symbols in literature and stories that come from the world of things that are alive that aren't necessarily human at all, trees and plants and animals, I love those stories if they're told well. How has nature inspired Anderson here, or how does he use nature to inspire us?
Anderson was very much a man after your own heart, who admired the natural world and found solace in it, has lots of stories about trees sheltering people and helping them, not quite to the level of Shel Silverstein's Giving Tree, but definitely in that vein of the connection between people and nature. And in this particular story, Anderson just focuses on one old oak tree that everyone has seen and the tree has seen generations pass. He's seen mayflies come and go every day, and he mourns the shortness of their lives, whereas for him, every year is like a day. And so he lives for these 365 years, and on the night the story takes place, he has lived this long, long life and seen so many things, and he doesn't really know yet what he thinks about all of it. And so we can, I think, any of us sitting under a tree, imagine, like, what has this tree seen? Knights and ladies and soldiers passing by and lovers picnicking. And so he puts us in that position, sort of we see the world through the oak tree's eyes, but we also see him watching us. And so it's this sort of meta conversation between us and the nature around us. And when a storm comes, it's Christmas Eve, and a storm blows up, and the tree is being torn from its roots, Anderson does this amazing job of narrating both the phenomenon of the storm tearing up the tree and the tree's experience of transcendence. As he's being lifted, literally, we know, but for him, this feels existential. His thought is for his friends, for the mayflies, for the flowers, for everything around him. And he realizes he doesn't want to go without everyone else, that he wants all of his friends to be saved. It's a little bit like X-Men here, like, you know, find all of them. And he wants all of them to come. And I think that moment of radical inclusivity is something that Anderson is not trying to make too heavy-handed and Christian, but really to recognize how important it is that we are inclusive with the people around us, that that's what will make us happy.
When he tells a tale like this, there's no way to answer this question. I'm going to ask an impossible question. Is he thinking this through in terms of I'm going to do this either as allegory, or I'm going to use these symbols to mean these certain concepts? Do you suppose he's crafting it in that way, or is it a little bit more organic? I'm kind of hoping the latter, that the story comes and then he thinks, well, that's kind of like life.
I think he's very much an organic storyteller. He's not one of those architects who builds the story first and makes it all fit. And sometimes his stories can get a little schmaltzy. He can get off base a little bit. And this one, I think you can read it that way as well, because, you know, it's Christmas Eve and the sailors all mourn the tree being gone the next morning on Christmas Day. But I think that the impulse of the story, he lets the story sort of tell itself. And this thinking of what would a tree have felt? What would a tree have seen? What would a tree then want? this tree, there's some beautiful artwork that illustrates it, I think, better even than the story tells it, just to show how complete the picture is when it's not just a tree by itself, but a tree surrounded by all the flowers and insects and plants that make up a whole ecosystem.
So you've talked about all of these stories and Hans Christian Andersen in our short time together in such a way that you sound very persuasive that this stuff isn't obsolete, that the stories he tells, the ideas behind the stories, the interpretations of them as having such a thing as like, you know, helping people to be more radically inclusive, to use your terminology, that this isn't just 19th century stuff. This is something for the 21st century too, that it's germane, that it hasn't evaporated as passé.
No, I think you're right there. I think that Andersen was ahead of his own time and that the things that he writes about are things that don't really go bad. They haven't become passé. We're still suffering and still struggling and still trying to find our way. And Andersen was, I think, one of the reasons that he has resonated with so many different cultures, has been translated into hundreds of languages, and has persisted so long as part of the canon of world literature, is because he gets at the pulse of our lives, that he understands the things that really do make us tick and make us hurt and make us weep and also make us rejoice.
I have to ask one last question. This might be a little subversive to everything we've talked about here, but I'm going to do it anyway, which is his reputation is that he was kind of gauche. That he was not socially – he didn't have a lot of finesse. You even said he couldn't dance. You know, I can't dance, so I can critique him on that. I just can't dance. For all of this investment in human values of compassion and mercy and inclusivity and you name it, and hope and optimism, could he walk the walk?
Well, he wasn't Jesus. telling the parables, he wasn't saying, because do as I do. I think it was more aspirational, that he was a man, probably a queer man, who lived in a time that didn't understand him, that didn't value him, that didn't really know what to do with him, but they were fascinated by him all the same. And so he tells these stories that people weren't quite sure what to do with then, or not quite sure what to do with now. And so his awkwardness, I think, is part of his charm, because he's not just saying, I have done all these things. I am preaching from my position of superiority. He's preaching from a place of vulnerability.
So much to think about, Julie. It's a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you about Hans Christian Andersen, and thank you for coming and being with us today.
Oh, I enjoyed it so much. Thank you.
Julie Allen with us, a professor of comparative literature and Scandinavian studies at Brigham Young University, talking about a few of the lesser-known tales, the forgotten tales, if you will, of Hans Christian Andersen. Some fairy tales have happy endings, others not so much. Some are dark. I'm hinting at the Grimm fairy tales. People were Disneyfying the Grimm brothers' fairy tales before Disney got around to it, you know. Have you heard the truth about Hansel and Gretel? Well, neither had anybody else in 1963 when a German writer published groundbreaking archaeological quote-unquote research. The truth behind Hansel and Gretel? We'll talk about it next on Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're talking about fairy tales this hour, and now it's time to turn to one of the many great slanders or indictments of stepmothers. Stepmothers, a group of people who never seem to get an even break in fairy tale plots. In 1963, a German writer published The Truth About Hansel and Gretel, claiming to have discovered an archaeological site, old bones, and some very burnt gingerbread. It was a hoax that gripped the world. I spoke with Claudia Schwabe about it. She's a professor of German at Utah State University.
I grew up with a lot of fairy tales that were read to me by my grandmother when I was little. Having been born in Hanau, and that's the same birthplace of the Brothers Grimm, so of course I was surrounded by Grimm fairy tales in general. So me, you could say me and the Brothers Grimm, we go way back. So I guess you in America are exposed to a lot of Disney, and you get the sweetened version, the sanitized version, so to say. But we in Germany, we actually do grow up with the Grimm's text. So very early on, we find out about, you know, the sisters of Cinderella who chop off their toe or their heel. and try to squeeze the bloody foot into the shoe, or you know, similar stories like that. So we don't really sanitize them. I can only speak for myself, but I remember that I actually thought it was thrilling when Gretel pushed the witch into the oven. And for me, it was just important that justice was served. And as a child, I think every child is different, of course. And if your child is afraid of fairy tales, the way they were written by the Grimms, then, you know, you have to make a careful selection. But I think most children don't picture it as graphic as an adult would. So I think for the most part, it's totally fine to read the version as written by the Brothers Grimm. Yeah, so for me, I have to say, I enjoyed it. Justice was served, and that was part of the intention of the Brothers Grimm. Both had studied law during their younger years, and that they were the sons of an Amtmann, which was a local judge. So justice was always very important to them.
Well, let's dive into a story. We want to do a little justice to this story of the hoax. What actually happened in the early 60s? There was somebody who somehow led people along and got them believing that, I guess, evidence had been found?
His name was actually Hans Johann Georg Kraxler. He was really just a children's book writer mostly, but he was also a cartoonist and illustrator. And in 1963, he published this book, Die Wahrheit über Hänsel und Gretel, The Truth About Hänsel and Gretel. He wrote this story as a parody, as a satire, as a persiflage. But of course, he didn't label it as such. He published it sort of as a hoax and to make fun of the field of archaeology and folklore, and people many people didn't get it. He inserted some clues in the story itself, but people took it for true value, and even the newspapers, and it got out there, word got out, and people were just amazed that this, what he called the fairy tale archaeology, the field of fairy tale archaeology, that he was the inventor of it, so to say.
Now, would you give us just the main delineations of what this book contained and claimed?
Basically, he comes up with this a figure named Georg Ossek, and he was supposed to be this amateur archaeologist born in Prague in 1919 and so forth. And he was a fairy tale aficionado, and he always, Ossek, the character, wanted to always prove somehow that fairy tales are true, or that there's some historical foundation to this. And so it just so happened in his life, in Ossek's life, that he came close to the Spessart forest in the state of Hesse. And he was determined to find out whether or not Hänsel and Gretel was true. So it's a long journey of him getting to the evidence of the so-called proof that this is the witch's forest, and where he found the foundations of the witch's house in the forest. And it's a long story, but it's a very detailed and sophisticated story of how he traced the journey based on the textual evidence and the illustrations that were published in one of the Grimm editions. And he went so far as to include some details about the witch and Hänsel and Gretel, basically that Hänsel and Gretel were adults and not children, according to his discovery, and that the witch was actually not a witch at all, and that she wasn't evil, but rather a very, very good baker, and that she was in possession of a recipe for gingerbread that later turned out to be the famous or popular Nürnberger Lebkuchen, sold until today in Germany. So according to his research, it turns out that the siblings, Hänsel and Gretel, killed the witch in order to find that recipe. So it was actually a murderous story.
And somewhere in this whole mix, there's actually an assertion that human remains were found of this woman, the witch.
So when he claims that he did some archaeological excavation and he found the basically the ovens, there were four ovens, and in there he found a skeleton of a female, approximately 35 years of age or 30 years. And then he said it was only half burnt, so he could have it analyzed. And he found out that the body or the woman was killed before she was put into the oven. And then he also found that there were some hints that the door, the hinge of the door, that it was broken into. So Hansel and Gretel broke into the witch's house. And then he finally found a box with some burnt Lebkuchen that allegedly then Hansel took, that he was actually the one. He didn't find the recipe, but he took some gingerbread from the house, and then he pretended that he was the baker, and he invented the Nuremberg Lebkuchen.
Now, I've got a connection here because I lived for a year in a city in Germany called Bielefeld, and one of the reasons Bielefeld is known has to do with this one Dr. Oetker, who is well known in Germany for recipes and baking and flour and puddings and what have you. And I guess that in this hoax, in this book, I maybe not fair to call it a hoax, a persiflage is what you called it, the recipe is identical to a Dr. Oetker recipe.
Exactly. So that was one of the clues that Trexler put in the book, but very few people noticed. And those who did notice, newspapers kept saying, but it is true. It wasn't until the very, very end that the truth came out that it's a persiflage. And people were angry. I mean, some of the people were really angry that they were fooled so dramatically. And they sent Trexler even a bill, like a gas bill, because they took a trip to the Spessart forest, or a very disgruntled lawyer actually sued him for fraud. So, and it wasn't only at the national level. It was international as well. There was a professor from a Japanese university, and he thought it was all true and wants to get the publication rights, and actually a lot of publishers asked for the translation rights of this book, and I believe there was even a university that wanted to award Georg Ostek, the character, with some sort of award for his amazing discovery.
This is just too good to be true. I mean, years ago I saw a hoax of a documentary where it showed spaghetti growing on trees and people were out.
Oh, yeah,
out.
I've seen that.
Yeah, people harvesting those spaghetti from trees. And you wonder at some point, how gullible can people really be? The newspapers and journalists picked this up. It was the mainstream press went with it.
I know, but you know what? I think the reason why people were sort of like, well, this could be true, because of the details that Trexler worked with. And even though, and the pictures, the illustrations, he included a lot of pictures in the book that seemed to be evidence. And even though, you know, the burnt gingerbread was actually a piece of lasagna, a burnt piece of lasagna. But in a picture, you didn't see that necessarily. And then he came up with historic documents that, I mean, he wrote the documents and made it look like it's a historic document. He did it so well, so on such a sophisticated level. I think that's why people got fooled.
He actually took some pride in what he was able to accomplish.
Oh,
he didn't set out to do it, but the way it played out and the way that he let people go with it and run with it, he had his fun, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, I think he absolutely did. And, I mean, there were even from Denmark, there were school classes. They wanted to travel to actually see the witch's house. And it was not just the everyday man or woman, but it was academics. They were fools, too.
Now, this is a quirky thing that happened back in the early 60s. And after a couple of years, it played out and people were mad and they knew the truth that they'd been had. Somewhere in your book, you pursue certain themes about people wanting the supernatural creatures. They want this stuff to be real. And I don't know if it's just kids. Is it humans in general, even adults?
Yes. So this is what I analyze in my book. I analyze why do we crave supernatural creatures. And I am very broad with this term because I include even superheroes such as the Avengers. in that. And really, what's really part of the book also is why do we, in our fairy tale adaptations today, why do we redeem villains and why do we reinvent these characters in a different way so that the villains become good and that the good ones become bad? So that's basically it. I had the idea first when I actually walked through the aisle of Walmart, and that there was in the girls section where the toys were, there were the Monster High dolls. Do you know these Monster High dolls?
No, I'm not familiar with them.
Okay, so these are the daughters and sons of traditional monsters, vampires, Frankenstein, and so forth. But they are cutified and beautified and made look cool and desirable. So I was wondering, that was the first time I started wondering, so why do we market these toys to our kids in that way? Why do we reinvent them that way? Then I started becoming really interested in digging. I did some digging and started to do research about this. And then I noticed while watching modern adaptations and television stories such as Once Upon a Time and Grimm, where I noticed all these characters are shown with a different, from a different angle and with a different twist. And I started analyzing it a bit more, and I just found that whereas German fairy tales treat otherness and difference with terror and distance and negativity, these modern adaptations navigate diversity by humanizing and redeeming these figures.
So the witch in Hansel and Gretel, if it were to be retold by, say, Disney, I don't know, has that been done? I don't think it's been done yet. There would be some saving grace. There'd be something nice. There'd be something we could be sympathetic about towards the witch.
Yeah, that's very likely. And also, I mean, one example also is there has been Hansel and Gretel witch hunters. So that's one of these twists I'm talking about. So these are not longer the little kids that are innocent and sweet, but they are dangerous and they are witch hunters. So that's one of the twists, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Claudia Schwabe, a professor of German at Utah State University. She's author of Craving Supernatural Creatures, German Fairy Tale Figures in American Pop Culture. Now here's a tale that sounds like a tall tale, but it isn't. It actually involves animals with rather short tails. What do you get when you cross a grizzly bear with a polar bear? You get a growler, or some people call them pizzlies. You get to pick. Either way, you want to stay out of their path. We're talking about pizzlies next, after the news on Constant Wonder.